This is Bristol Band Beyond, our weekly news magazine on KDLG. It's Friday, August 14th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, an update from the EPA on the salvage of the vessel Challenger and its barge, which still sits sunk up on the Nooshigak River.
It takes a while. I mean, some of the salvage operations are pretty complicated. It's all based on how the vessels are situated at the bottom of the river.
Plus, Pebble is raising money to continue funding its operations. We'll hear from sole owner Northern Dynasty about what's ahead for the controversial project. We'll see what's happening at one of our local farms in full bloom this season and take a trip down the Pungyopuk River with some area teens. Continuing our hunting season conversations with area managers, Dave Crowley joins from King Salmon to talk about the moose, caribou, and the very lucrative trophy brown bear hunt on the Alaska Peninsula.
The previous biologist estimated that the hunt was worth, just in guide and transporter fees alone, worth about $10 million.
And speaking of brown bears, this week a video of a couple of Great Pyrenees chasing one off a Dillingham driveway is going viral on Facebook.
We've been giving them treats, and I patted them today and told them they were movie stars.
Those stories and more are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. At about 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, a tug and barge operated by Ridge Contracting overturned coming down the Nooshigak River. The vessels sunk in shallow water. The barge was loaded with scrapped vehicles from Nooshigak being shipped out. The two men on board the Challenger were picked up hours later by fish and game biologists traveling down the river during what they reported to be extremely windy conditions. The Coast Guard took initial oversight of the spill prevention and cleanup operations. Petty Officer Patrick Brown told KDLG News Monday that there was not believed to be a substantial amount of fuels on board the vessel.
And the Challenger has a max capacity of 300 gallons for fuels on board. And the responsible party is reporting that there's 100 gallons of diesel on board at the time that the vessel sunk.
Some boaters have reported to KDLG News that the smell of fuel and oils has increased this week, as has the sheen in the water. The salvage has not been completed. Bridge Contracting has not responded to requests for comment this week. Many around the state are gearing up for a visit by President Barack Obama later this month. The White House released a video to highlight the purpose of the president's trip to the 49th state.
Hi, everybody. Later this month, I'm going to Alaska. And I'm going because Alaskans are on the front lines of one of the greatest challenges we face this century, climate change.
Mr. Obama will be speaking at an Arctic policy conference sponsored by the State Department in Anchorage on Monday and or Tuesday, the 31st and 1st of September. It's believed he will make a stop in Dillingham on Wednesday, September 2nd, and also on to Kotzebue. On the first day to declare candidacy, two sitting Dillingham City Council members announced their intent to run against incumbent Mayor Alice Ruby for the city's top elected job this fall. Tracy Hightower says he has his eye on guiding a more conservative approach to city finances.
I think there's a lot of work the city needs to do. We need to cut a lot of our spending. I mean, we're overspending in a lot of departments, and also we're way overtaxing our citizens. It's getting a lot of people to move out of town.
Holly Johnson says she's running to spearhead some change in the community.
I definitely think that we should be collaborating more with our tribes. I also think that we should be communicating better with our citizens, and I do think that the city as a whole needs to collaborate better within its own agency.
Alice Ruby tells KDLG News she is running for re-election. The election is scheduled for October 6th. The Lake and Peninsula School District announced it will not be opening the Igigig School this year. Superintendent Ty Mace says it was clear the school would not have the 10 students required by the state for funding. He says it wasn't clear there were any students planning to enroll this year.
Each spring, we do intend to enroll forms. This spring, we didn't have any turned in for Igigig. Right now, as far as we can tell, there's about six school-age children in the village. But again, we don't have enrollment forms. And from what we can tell, they're far from the minimum of 10 students needed to open a school.
Mace says they hope to see Igigig rebound and reopen, as happened in Chignik Bay 2 years ago. Changes to the federal program that provides free school lunches for the families of low-income students will now make a free lunch and breakfast available to all students at Dillingham City Schools this coming year. Superintendent Danny Frazier says the USDA lowered the threshold for community poverty levels.
If you have 40% poverty in your district, you now qualify for every child in the school to be able to get free lunch and free breakfast.
The 40% threshold is down from the prior 80%. Dillingham City Schools is still trying to hire a special education teacher and a music teacher ahead of the start of the year. Students are expected back on Monday, August 31st. Alaska authorities say the 2015 fire season is now the third largest on record, as 743 fires have burned more than 5 million acres. The only two seasons larger are 1957 and 2004, the latter of which counted more than 6.5 million acres burned across the state. On our crime and safety beat, the Coast Guard rescued a man and pregnant woman off the 29-foot vessel Yo-Yo near Togiak last weekend after the vessel's engine stopped working in what became stormy and rough conditions on the seas. A helicopter hoisted the two off the boat and flew them back to Togiak unharmed. A former computer network manager at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation has been indicted on 76 counts of possessing and distributing child pornography. Gene Geisler was picked up Wednesday night outside of Charleston, South Carolina. Authorities say Geisler is in possession of one of the largest amounts of child pornography the state has ever investigated. Troopers ended a lengthy standoff in Iliamna peacefully Sunday night after 29-year-old Lee Ludvick refused to exit his parents' house. He was believed to be armed and had allegedly fired shots into the home while occupants were inside. A robot rover used by troopers entered the home first and found Ludvick apparently passed out inside. He was arrested and charged with four separate criminal offenses. And the Iliamna Trooper Post says it's investigating four separate reports of alleged sexual assault against juveniles, three involving females and one involving a male. The incidents were reported by the Office of Children's Services earlier this month. Find more on this week's news at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond. We'll begin this week with an update. The company that was operating the tug and barge that went down in the Nooshigak River has not been inclined to interview with us, but they are keeping agencies overseeing the cleanup and salvage apprised of the situation. Yesterday afternoon, I spoke with EPA on-scene coordinator Bob Whittier for the latest on the sunk 45-foot vessel Challenger.
Right now, the responsible party is putting together a plan to actually salvage the vessel. It's going to take some time, given its location. In a very remote spot of the Nooshigak River. It takes a while. I mean, some of the salvage operations are pretty complicated. It's all based on how the vessels are situated at the bottom of the river. Right now, they might be having a little issues with the depth. I guess it's pretty shallow in that area, so they're getting the right machinery, the right vessels to actually undertake the salvage operation. A little bit of sheen coming off of it, but that should be rectified once the vessels are removed from the river. Not much we can do about a sheen, unfortunately. It's very, very small concentrations, but we'll definitely get to it, and we're definitely providing oversight until this is seen done.
All right. Bob, a few people that are near that site on the river have let us know that they smell more oil or fuel, and they're noticing more sheen than they did initially. Is that just kind of standard, that it begins to seep out more and sort of causes more of a noticeable impact? Are you concerned by that?
Anytime you have a vessel sinking, the primary thing is, you know, the fuel tanks and whatnot. But in this situation, we have crushed vehicles. They originally drained all the oil, all the fluids out of them. But there's going to be some minor sheening associated with that. And with sheen, too, you can't really pick it up with anything. It's hard to respond to. And we respond to it with sorbent materials, but they're primarily ineffective. You know, some of it can volatilize and that type of thing, but like I said, you know, the sooner, of course, you know, there is going to be some minor impacts, but the sooner we can get the vessels out, the better.
And has Ridge provided any sort of a best-case scenario time frame to you as to when this might all be able to happen?
Nothing specific. It'd probably be a couple days, I'm thinking, you know, based on my conversation with the PRP. But like I said, you know, things can change, weather can change, currents can change, that type of thing. So we're just keeping apprised of the situation and providing oversight to it, and I'll probably have some updates in the future.
All right, Bob Whittier with the EPA. Thank you so much for the update.
Yeah, thanks.
Now, another update. This week, Northern Dynasty announced it was planning investment strategies to raise some $15 million cash. Northern has not had the backing of a major mining partner since Anglo American left the partnership 3 years ago. Joining me now for more on this is Sean McGee, the Vice President for Communications at Northern Dynasty. Sean, good to speak with you. It was announced this week that Northern Dynasty is taking some steps to raise some finances. Explain what's happening here. It's a little hard to decipher.
Yeah, that's correct, Dave. We have we did a previous financing, I think, in December of last year, essentially to provide operating funds for the company as we move forward with the Pebble project in Alaska. So the financing we did now, as you said, $15 million U.S. or roughly $20 million Canadian, is in the same order, simply to provide operating funds as we continue to move forward with the project.
What's this other company that Northern is acquiring basically for their cash assets here?
So Cannon Point Resources was another mineral exploration development company, a company that I believe didn't currently have a mineral property. I think the management and board of that company believed that an investment in Northern Dynasty and then the Pebble Project was in the best interest of their shareholders. So the transaction that occurred was essentially a plan of arrangement whereby the cash that they had on hand would go into Northern Dynasty's coffers, and then in exchange, shareholders in Cannon Point Resources would receive shares in Northern Dynasty.
Right now, what does Northern Dynasty need to pay for towards the Pebble project? It sounds like the work site is quiet again this summer. Is that the case? And if so, what's being spent on?
Yeah, it is relatively quiet. We have some, certainly the site is under care and maintenance, and we have a small staff in Iliamna that's charged with that. We do some modest amount of ongoing environmental work just to keep some of the data streams consistent and up to date. But really the focus, I think the focus of our activities right now is to address the EPA's preemptive regulatory action under Section 404C of the Clean Water Act to ensure that the Pebble Project can in the future initiate federal and state permitting unencumbered by any extraordinary development restrictions. So we have a fair bit of work underway. Certainly litigation is underway. There's a couple of different investigations of EPA's actions with respect to Pebble. The other thing we're very focused on is qualifying and securing a new major funding partner for the project. And I think in both of those areas, both addressing the EPA risk as well as seeking a new funding partner, we continue to make gains towards those objectives, and would hope we'll have more to announce later this year.
No companies that you can mention yet that are interested in being a partner with Northern?
We can't. There is a formal due diligence process whereby confidentiality agreements are signed, and that would restrict us from really talking about any parties who may be looking into the Pebble Project in Northern Dynasty.
Now, we know that there's a federal lawsuit underway, and as far as I know, there's no updates yet in that case. But you mentioned investigations. One of those, I believe, has been undertaken by former Secretary of Defense William Cohen. Any updates on that independent investigation from his group?
Only that I think we expect that investigation to conclude and Secretary Cohen to report out in the latter part of this year. So I believe this fall we would expect that report to be made public.
Okay. Sean, final question for you today. Pebble Mine is certainly a contentious issue, and it's not popular here, but I want to know, when you see incidents like happened in Colorado recently or Mount Polley a year ago, does that give Northern Dynasty or its potential investors pause for concern about advancing Pebble where it's located here in the Bristol Bay watershed?
Well, certainly, given the location of the Pebble Project in southwest Alaska and the significance of the fisheries resources there, we have long said this is a project that has to have the very highest environmental standards enforced. We fully expect that. You know, we certainly believe that in the modern world that mines can be engineered to ensure that they're safe and stable and reliable. We wholly expect to apply those standards to our work at Pebble, and that work should be heavily scrutinized by not just the federal and state regulatory agencies involved in permitting, but the people of Bristol Bay and Alaska. So we do have confidence that a project can be developed that will protect those resources, that will, you know, create meaningful benefits for the people of the region and the state. But it's really the permitting process under NEPA that will ultimately be the point in time at which the plans that we put forward are measured and decisions can be taken as to whether they provide sufficient safeguards for, you know, the important resources, in particular the fishery resources of Bristol Bay.
Sean McGee with Northern Dynasty Minerals. Sean, thanks for the update, as always.
Always good to talk to you, Dave. Thanks.
As summer turns towards fall and the other harvests begin, who doesn't enjoy finding themselves standing in line at a farmer's market? In Dillingham, there are two, maybe three farms that supply the fresh produce that shoppers quickly snatch up Wednesdays and Saturdays. KDLG's Hannah Colton recently spent a morning out at one of those farms, or rather oversized gardens, over on Unicorn Lane.
For decades, Patricia Carscallon has spent her summers juggling both fishing and farming. This season, a hip injury kept her off the boat. I asked her what it was like to spend a whole season in the soil.
It was different, but it was such a glorious summer for gardening. I didn't miss the fishing as much as I thought I would.
Her efforts are clearly well placed here. The gardens are exploding. Carscallon walks me through a few of her daily tasks. First on the list, pollinate the zucchini.
We got bees around here, sort of, but they're bumblebees and they're kind of lazy and bumbly and they don't pollinate very well. So you pretty much have to hand pollinate even the outside stuff.
She takes a small toothbrush, scrapes pollen from a male squash blossom, and rummages through the big floppy leaves looking for a girl flower.
Aha! Sometimes you get all male flowers, sometimes you get all female flowers, and in that case, you don't get squash.
Carscallon's high tunnel greenhouse is a jungle of organized chaos. The wide rows are packed with vegetables, herbs, and bright flowers. As she points out the different plants, she keeps picking things for me to try.
Taste that relative to, say, store-bought celery. Whole different critter, huh?
Yeah.
Same thing, only more so.
Mm-hmm.
Carscallon loves introducing people to new veggies. And it works both ways. She says sometimes her customers turn her on to new plants.
Yeah, I don't like licorice, so I never grew fennel. And then one of my customers wanted fennel, so I started growing it. And sometimes it sold, sometimes it didn't. So I started eating it when I brought it home. And I've realized, actually, I really like fennel.
To have folks in town begging for fennel, Carscallon says that would have been unthinkable 20 years ago.
Well, there's a generation of people here who had canned peas and potatoes and onions that came up on the barge as, you know, their vegetables.
Then about 15 years back, Carscallon and a few other local growers got together to start the downtown farmers market. She says what started as a way to get rid of her extra vegetables steadily grew into a staple for the community. She says they were one of the first markets in Alaska to accept WIC cards.
People were coming because they had to use up their coupons, and then they found out their kids liked vegetables, which is great. The kids were eating stuff the parents never had.
Whenever those kids would snack on snap peas or visit the farm on a field trip, she says they were learning to love veggies. And now she hopes they'll pass it on.
I'm hoping we've made a difference. I know we've made a difference. I'm just thrilled to see that. I'm more tickled to see the kids that grew up with my kids coming and bringing their children. That gives me a lot of satisfaction because hopefully, you know, the whole diabetes epidemic around here and whatnot, hopefully that can be helped.
That, on top of having delicious fresh food for herself, is what makes all the work worth it. It's the chance to make Dillingham a little healthier, one zucchini blossom at a time. For KDLG, I'm Hannah Colton.
On this program this month, we've been bringing you conversations with area wildlife managers as we move into the fall hunting season. This week, I'm joined by Dave Crowley, who manages the Area 9 GMUs up and down the Alaska Peninsula. Good to speak with you. Thanks for making time for KDLG here.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to be here.
Well, let's talk about the Unit 9s. But they are confusing. Anybody that looks at the map can tell. You've got quite a jumbled area to manage here, but let's jump in with moose. I don't think it's as big of a hunt as it kind of is for other areas in Bristol Bay. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Our moose density tends to be pretty low in Unit 9 overall. We have much better brown bear habitat than we do moose habitat for the most part. So that's why we have fairly complicated regulations. Most of the hunts are geared towards satisfying the needs of our local hunters, and as a result, non-resident opportunity is limited. And our hunter success is fairly low, with the exception of Unit 9E, which is south of here. Hunter success down there is pretty good, but it's a remote area. Access is difficult and expensive. But that's probably our highest moose density down there, and hunters do pretty well.
All right. Caribou-wise, the 17s and the 9 share the Mulchatna on your northern end there, the Mulchatna herd. So I'd like to ask you about that, but there's also some kind of good news to start reporting about some of the caribou down a little bit further south on the peninsula.
Yes. The southern Alaska Peninsula herd, which is down there in Unit 9D, it's the southern tip of the Alaska Peninsula, that herd is doing well. We started a subsistence hunt on that a couple of years ago, and next year we're going to a general season, a harvest ticket for that herd for both residents and non-residents.
How long has that been, Dave, since they've had that hunt?
Oh, I think it's been since 2006. It was before I took the job here. So, yeah, it's been almost a decade. And the population has responded immediately to some predator control that we did right on the calving grounds. And it's been growing ever since. Calf survival is looking pretty good, and the population is increasing. So we're pretty pleased about that.
Well, that's certainly good news. How about the Northern Peninsula herd?
Yeah, the NAP similarly is increasing. We have not started a hunt on it yet. We're not quite there. But I anticipate that in next year, 2016, or at the latest, 2017, if the population continues to increase and survival remains high, that we'll start with a subsistence hunt there and hopefully eventually move up to a registration hunt. That will provide more opportunity for locals and residents alike. But that's a few years down the road. But look for hunting on the NAP next year, the year after, for local residents.
What's the fish and game perspective on what has helped the herd to get back to better shape? And what are the numbers looking like, by the way, right now?
Well, on the NAP, we're looking at just over probably 2,500 animals. The caribou are, just by their nature, are cyclical. And, you know, we saw in most of southwest Alaska, we saw all the caribou populations kind of decline at the same time. And that gives, when that occurs, that gives the range time to rehabilitate for more of the vegetation that they're grazing to recover. And then at the same time, at lower density, the caribou become healthier, there's less disease or parasite loading and that kind of thing. So they just, the kind of all works together and they start cycling upward again.
Well, I've got to ask you about the brown bear hunt, because I think you're one of the most popular spots in the state or maybe the world to come in for this. It has to be big business.
It is. Yeah, we manage for trophy bear hunting on the Alaska Peninsula, and so to do that, to manage harvest, one of the things we do is have hunts every other year instead of every year. We're coming up on a fall hunt this year. The previous biologist, my predecessor, estimated that the hunt was worth, just in guide and transporter fees alone, worth about $10 million on the open years.
That's local economy and everything?
Well, it's more than local. It's probably more like South Central Alaska. Some of the guides are non-resident guides, so they're coming up from the lower 48. But for the most part, that's being injected into the Alaskan economy.
Wow, $10 million as an estimate. That's a That's substantial.
Yes, and our harvest is fairly high. We're looking at about 600 bears every other year, and good harvest success. We've got very high bear density on the peninsula, and as you mentioned, it is one of the most important in the state.
Do you feel like the brown bear hunt has maybe easing back some of the predator against the moose and caribou that people would maybe rather hunt locally, or locals would rather hunt?
Well, you'd really have to take a lot more bears than we do in order to impact the prey populations. The bears really don't have that much of an impact, except possibly when calves are first born. Both moose and caribou calves, certainly there are bears that specialize in that. But overall, the harvest really has, the bear harvest has little impact on our prey populations.
Oh, okay. Dave Crowley is the wildlife biologist for GMU Nines up and down the Alaska Peninsula, based in the office in King Salmon. Dave, good to speak with you. Thanks so much.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you, Dave.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. Every year, the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge organizes a high school science camp conducted via float trip. Earlier this month, six high school students from Dillingham and Twin Hills floated the Pungyopuk River. KDLG's Molly Dishner joined them as a chaperone and brought back this story.
Bristol Bay is known for fish, and the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge is no exception. During the high school float camp on the Pungo River, it was rainbows and resident species, not reds, that lured anglers to keep casting.
Woo! Matt!
Wow!
Good day! Matt, I should be tallying up what fish I get, because yesterday I got a pike.
That was Savannah Sage catching yet another rainbow, while refuge manager Susanna Henry rode our inflatable blue raft downstream. Prior to the trip, Sage had caught just one rainbow this summer, up at Lake Aleknagik. A day into the float, her tally was up to more than half a dozen and climbing. The river stretches 16 miles from Pungo Lake to the Togiak River. The sun was shining nearly the entire time we were on the water, and until the final day, a light breeze kept the bugs away. 16 miles might sound like a short trip, but there's enough fish in the Pungo to make every mile last. It took us 4 days, with plenty of stops for fishing. Drew Wassily caught his first rainbow ever on the trip, but he said it was his tentmate and fishing partner, Carlton Small of Twin Hills, who is the most prolific fisher.
He's the rainbow slaying machine.
On the last day of camp, Small says he had caught about 30 fish over the course of the trip. That doesn't include the smolt caught by the whole group. Campers set out minnow traps before bed on the first night, baited with bacon. The next morning, refuge education specialist Terry Fuller helped intern Connor Ito and the campers ID the smolt they found waiting for them.
Well, I've got a little bit of white and black, look.
Yes.
There is on the one.
Yeah, okay, so this is a silver.
So there are silvers.
This is to be found.
This is typical rearing habitat.
Camp wasn't just about catching fish. Students also put on a dry suit to snorkel with fish, and there were non-fishy activities too. Fire building, berry picking, a leave-no-trace activity, and hours on the river identifying plants and birds. But Ito, a former camper herself, offered perhaps the most important lesson of all, how to roast a Twinkie.
Now you want to very slowly roast the Twinkie until it is crunchy and golden brown on the outside more than it already is, and the filling is bubbling out of the holes at the bottom. That means that it's heated all the way through, and then you may eat the Twinkie.
The verdict?
I taste more buttery.
In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
Finally on this week's show, wow, does the internet love pet videos? Who can blame any among us who kills a few minutes of the day watching a cat slide down the stairs in a box? In Alaska, popular pet videos often pit the domesticated and the wild, and those videos can go viral. One such is doing that right now. More than 120,000 people have already viewed video the Fox family captured as their Great Pyrenees dogs Ivy and Hazel chased a brown bear out of their Dillingham driveway Tuesday night. Annie Fox shot the video. Her mom, Starla Fox, spoke with me yesterday. Starlet, tell me first about this incident here. It's amusing to watch and talk about now, but I imagine there was a little anxiety at the time. When did this happen and what was going on?
Well, it happened a couple of nights ago. I was actually snoozing and my daughter woke me up and said, Mom, there's a bear in the yard. So I go out to the living room and she's videoing this bear trying to come into our yard. And of course, the girls, the dogs, I call them my girls, they were on night shift doing their duty. So they kept the bear out.
Were you or your daughter kind of nervous at all as this was happening?
Oh, I was very nervous, and primarily because my 11-year-old son was still down at his friend's house, who lived down the road in the direction of where the bear was traveling to when it left our driveway.
Okay, now the girls, as you call them, Ivy and Hazel, these Great Pyrenees, they didn't back down. They did a great job, right?
Oh, they love that. That's
that's kind of what they're bred for?
Yeah, that is what they're bred for. They're 2 years old, and that's actually the second set of Pyrenees that we've had.
The bear ambles off here, and you have the video, and you share it to whom?
Well, I stay in touch with the breeder that that sent me the dogs, and she's from Kansas. And so I occasionally will send her photos of the dogs, you know, as they were pups and growing up. We stay in touch, and I sent her the video clip to her Facebook site. And my email has just exploded with notifications of people who have viewed the video and have shared the video, and lots of comments.
What are people telling you?
You know, a lot of people who own this particular breed, who raise sheep and goats, and they use them in the pasture to protect the herds, and they were just thrilled to see them in action against a large predator.
I imagine most people who have Pyrenees don't have brown bears on their property very often.
There's a lot of comments about the coyotes. I think there's a large population of coyotes in the lower 48 who try to, approach sheep, herds of sheep and herds of goats. So I'm not sure how often you would get a video like this.
Is the Fox family kind of proud to see their Ivy and Hazel, you know, become famous overnight like this?
Well, we've been giving them treats, and I patted them today and told them they were movie stars.
They were wagging their tails in the video. Do they know this was a good job well done? I mean, is this instinctive for a Pyrenees?
I think it is instinctive for a Pyrenees. One of my friends that I worked with on night shift, Monty, he was a nurse here at the hospital, and he used to ranch in Montana, and he recommended this breed of dog for me, and he said they'll imprint on whatever you raise them with. So if you have sheep, they love sheep and they'll protect them to the death. And if you raise them with kids, they'll love your kids and they'll stand between them and whatever is trying to approach them. So I went with the Pyrenees, and I have not been disappointed in that decision.
Well, it seems like they did their job. We'll keep an eye on that video and see just how viral it goes. But
yeah.
I was going to critique a little bit, like the video kind of left out the stars at a few points.
Yeah, we were really focused on the bear, a little worried about the bear.
Well, All right, Starla Fox, thank you so much.
Sure, thanks, Dave.
And you can find that video at our website. That's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. Stay in touch with us. We appreciate your feedback, story ideas, songs, poems, and essays. I'm Dave Benninger. Reach me at dave@kdlg.org. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here next week.